and welcome to a special series from the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be releasing four retrospectives of these amazing interviews that we did at Rocky Mountain Psych Association. And to accompany those are going to be this, which is a supercut of 2 to 3 interviews that we did. And so if you'd like to kind of listen to all of them at once and then listen to our retrospective, or listen to our retrospective, and then you're interested in listening to the episodes, well, here they are. If you are interested in it, listening to these episodes solo, just one, you want to, you know, download and listen to it, whatever. All the links are in the description below for all the separate ones. But we're going to be kind of going through a number of kind of clusters or collectives that kind of mesh together. And so, I hope you enjoy. And this is sort of a little intro as we kind of get into it. So with no further ado, enjoy these great interviews that we did at Rocky Mountain Psych Association 2023. Bye, everyone. All right, yeah, we're back here live at RMPA, and we're continuing our kind of discussion with some of the attendees and their interviews. So we're going to start and let you introduce yourself and your research.
Excellent. Thank you so much. My name is Kimberly Monroe, and my research is into how the COVID pandemic affected university students' mental health. Mm-hmm. And I started my program in 2020, in the fall of 2020, and you know, right in the height of the mm-hmm. pandemic at that time. And I just kept thinking about, everyone was impacted in some way on the planet in various ways, but my heart especially went out to the class of 2020 mm-hmm. because they missed out on so many rites of passage mm-hmm. as far as like, prom, graduation, all these senior things. The students who play sports weren't able to get that senior year in. Same with juniors, which is really important if they're trying to go play at university. And so I just kind of wanted to check in on their mental health, but I'd never done this kind of research before. My background is in English literature. So, to be honest, I didn't really know what I was doing.
Sure.
And so I was kind of winging it, and I decided to just use some established scales that have already been created. So if you went to the psychologist and they thought you might have depression or anxiety, mm-hmm. they would give you these scales. So the GAD-7 for anxiety, mm-hmm. the PHQ-8 for depression. Yeah. And then there's a newly created scale called the CAS, the Coronavirus Anxiety Scale, which was created in 2020 yeah. to find out dysfunctional levels of coronavirus anxiety.
Yeah.
And then lastly, research has shown that people who are more resilient, this is sort of a protective factor against mental health issues such as depression and anxiety. And so there's a scale for that as well. There's several of them, but the CDRAS C10 is what I gave to students. So those four scales, and I gave them in 2020 and again in 2021 and 2022, but it really surprised me, the results in 2020. So after data cleaning, I had an N of about 177, or not about, it was 177. Yeah. And I have the averages here because I'm not great at memorizing numbers. So in that first scale, the average for the GAD-7 was an 8.88. And the mild to moderate anxiety is 5 to 9. And so moderate starts at 9. And so 8.88 is the high end of mild anxiety. So that kind of surprised me. And then again, with depression, same, the average was a 9.04. The cutoff for moderate depression is 10. So again, right below the moderate cutoff, so high, mild. And then what really shocked me, especially being in the fall of 2020, because we were still very much implemented in pandemic protocol. So students, most of them did not have in-person classes. Mm-hmm. There was masking everywhere. Students who either tested positive or even were just exposed to COVID were sent to isolation dorms for 11 days where they had to spend by themselves. And then media messaging, too, at the time was very, very intense as far as, like, death count tickers, mm-hmm. and reminding us how deadly and scary COVID is. And so for the CAS, it's scored from 0 to 20. Anything over 9 indicates dysfunctional COVID anxiety. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, out of 177 students, the mean was a 1.96.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
That's really low.
That's really low. And I was a bit confused by this. And that actually led to some follow-up research about the scale itself. Like, is this scale functioning as intended?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's the hypothesis here? Is just nobody's actually scared of COVID at the university? Or is the scale not functioning as intended? Well, and then lastly, the CDR-ISC-10 is scored from 0 to 40, and so 40 being extremely resilient, and the mean was a 35.65. So that's another hypothesis, is that perhaps students who attended university in 2020 had self-selected as being resilient, because maybe if they were extremely anxious, depressed, scared of COVID, they didn't attend university in 2020. Maybe they took a year off.
It's probably explained by some of those enrollment drops that we saw during that time. I mean, we're probably still seeing to an extent now.
Is that, we are. Yeah.
That difference between, again, that student who's like, you know what, I'm going to stick it through and I'm going to go, or maybe they're not as worried because the university has some procedures in place or has a lockdown or is doing classes on Zoom. So if they're at home, there might be that kind of buffer, but right. Then these are also students who are staying on campus in the dorms and stuff like that. So,
right. So it kind of surprised me. So then I gave these same scales to university faculty at the, so this would have been end of fall semester, beginning of spring semester. Mm-hmm. And the results were essentially the same, only their coronavirus anxiety was even a bit lower. It was about a 1.78. And so again, what's going on here? And like I said, I could talk about follow-up research using Roche assessment to find out if the scale is actually able to parse out mild to moderate coronavirus anxiety, which after doing some analysis with collapsed data of, so it was like 638 entries that I had after 3 years of data collection. And it is showing a floor effect where the CAS seems to be able to parse out, like, if you have extreme dysfunctional COVID anxiety, it will be able to pick that up, but it's not sensitive enough to really parse out mild to moderate. And, you know, hopefully at this point, maybe we don't need to use the scale as much anymore. I'm kind of hoping that we won't be doing any more pandemic research. But yeah, this really surprised me because, you know, I'm a student, but I'm also an instructor, and I was hearing a lot from my students, very depressed, very anxious, and then they take this anonymous survey, and it's not reflecting that. So, and then each subsequent year, so I gave it again in 2021, scores were about the same, mild to moderate cutoff for anxiety, depression, high end of mild for both. And then the coronavirus anxiety dropped to a 1.15 in 2021 and then dropped to a 0.96 in 2022. So that's the only statistically significant drop. All the others maintained high end of mild for anxiety and depression. And then high resiliency each year, so 35.65, 36.51, 35.52, staying highly resilient. And not to minimize any level of depression or anxiety, but I'm a lifelong student, and I feel like just personally, my baseline is probably the high end of mild to moderate anxiety and depression, you know?
Right.
So that doesn't seem extraordinarily higher out of the ordinary to me. So that was the most interesting part of my research. It's like, okay, well, it seems like maybe the students are doing okay. Or like I said, they've self-selected, and students who were not doing okay didn't spend the money to attend university. They stayed home or did something else, perhaps.
Did your university, like one of the things that I think of with this is maybe like at a university where there wasn't as, I guess, clear of a guideline, or if the guidelines were a little slow rolling, that maybe there would have been maybe some more anxiety for the incoming students because they didn't know, or at a university where maybe it was a little more polarized or politicized, like in a state where it was a little more difficult for the university to do something about it, if maybe there would have been. But I don't know, that self-selection issue keeps kind of coming up.
Yeah, and at this point, you know, it's a bit too late for me to be able to survey students at other universities. Like I said, I'm happy that I was able to get some data during the pandemic. I wish I would have got more, but I'm very hopeful that I don't get the opportunity to do this research again. But yeah, I especially just felt bad for them because I also missed out on part of my senior year. Not due to a pandemic. It was poor choices. I was expelled my senior year. And it was supposed to be for the whole year, but I was able to appeal and rejoin my class the second half. But I had missed that first half of my senior year. And so, you know, missing homecoming and undoubtedly the opportunity to be crowned homecoming queen.
Right.
I'm kidding about that. But, you know, these rites of passage, and I look back at the things that I missed, and you know, is prom the most important event in a human's life? Like, no, probably not. Hopefully not.
I didn't even want to go.
Yeah. but is there anything else like prom in a human's life? No. And these students missed out on that. And then graduation as well. You know, it's 18 years of hard work and then not getting that opportunity to really be recognized. I know different schools did like drive-through things or tried to make it special in some way, but like I said, even the class of 2020 who took this survey were reporting that they're extremely resilient, which is the messaging that we heard. Kids are resilient, which I do believe they are, but I also feel like this can be like a fallback excuse to mistreat people. Like, oh, they'll be okay, they're resilient, that they'll deal with it, it's okay. And so that was really the basis of wanting to do this. But like I said, the results were surprising, and I'm comforting in a way too. Like, okay, these students seem to be doing well. And the last measurement that I took was at the beginning of, fall of 2022. Mm-hmm. So last semester. And same, they're reporting that they're doing all right. The smallest N that I had was 145, which isn't huge, but not too small. I mean, it's still...
Is I guess sort of a last question, because like you mentioned, like, you know, like thinking about, well, if, you know, we could have done this, or like looking back in it in retrospect, especially because this was kind of a sudden event. This was for, I think, a lot of researchers, and then this opportunity, like not one that we want to have again.
Right.
But one that offered an opportunity to look at some of these if you could kind of like hit the ground running early, which usually means that you're kind of like cobbling stuff together and learning as you go. Looking at this in retrospect, like based on what you've learned with this sort of, these, you know, three points of longitudinal data collection, like what would you do differently? Like if you woke up tomorrow and you had to do this all over again, what would you do differently? Or what do you think would be like what is like the thing that you learned from this in terms of like the methodology of it?
That's a great question. I would have collected so much more research. I'm doing mostly quantitative. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to do more interviews and do some qualitative because, you know, we have the results here, but the question of why. And I'd like to be asking why. And then also, I wasn't really aware of how intense the social isolation was for students who were in quarantine until later on, because I'd have students saying, oh, I'm in quarantine for 10, 11 days in 2021. And I didn't know what that entailed. They didn't really tell me that they were going to another dorm where it's not really furnished. They don't really have anything. The food is just set by their door. And then I had a student in spring of 2021 tell me that he spent 56 days in social isolation.
That's like prison. Like,
right. Mm-hmm. And the way that he presented it too sounded like he'd been in the hole. Oh, he's like, I spent 56 days in there. I'm not going back. And he was an athlete. And so the athletes were being tested more often than anyone else. And so not only if they tested positive, even if they weren't feeling ill, you know, if they tested positive, but also if one of their teammates tested positive, then they would all go into isolation. And so I would have liked to do more interviews and then maybe these specific surveys too with students who had, you know, been alone in a room for 11 days. And those kind of impacts, like I really wish I would have been able to tell those students' stories. Now it's kind of with people's memories and far out, I don't know if it would be as useful anymore. Yeah. And then, like you said, other students at other universities, and then also, you know, healthcare workers and, you know, just different professions that were impacted in different ways. And so not only this quantitative of being able to like fill out the surveys and get those numbers, but then adding the qualitative as well, just being able to ask like, why?
Yes.
How did things go for you? How did you adapt? Are you?
Yes.
And so that's what I would have done, is just collected a lot more data. But I'm glad I was able to get something.
Yeah.
Right.
And kind of document this period, because I was like, hopefully we don't do it again. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. But it's important to look back and reflect and see what was done, what worked, what didn't. If this does happen again, how are we going to respond now that we have some real world experience? Because, you know, prior to this, the last one was like 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a different world that we live in now.
Right.
So,
right. Well, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for this opportunity.
It was a joy really talking to you about your research.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Hello. Yeah, we're back live at RMPA, and we're here with Erica and Jen to talk about their research on Indigenous perspectives of mental health. And so I'm going to start by letting you introduce yourselves, who you are, where you're from, and then tell us a bit about your research.
Hi, my name is Erica, and I am a six-year student in the Clinical and Counseling Program at Utah State University. I'm a member of the Tlingit and Oglala Lakota tribes.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jennifer Yazzie. I am a part of the Navajo Nation. I am a second year in the Combined Clinical Counseling Psychology Program at Utah State. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, no, thank you for talking with us. So I saw this you know, kind of looking through who was doing presentations and like who we could try to get in touch with, and there's a good theme here of Indigenous perspectives of mental health, and a lot of students doing posters and whatnot, and so I was very excited to reach out to you guys. We have a large Indigenous student population at our university, which is a lot of the universities in the Southwest, and so I think it's an important thing to talk about. So why don't you tell us about like what you guys were looking at and sort of what you found or what you focused on in your research?
Well, it was a qualitative study. So what we did is we held sharing circles, which is a Indigenous research methodology that's similar to focus groups, and it's also very similar to talking circles, which is, you know, like a cultural way that we come together to share information, you know, discuss important things, you know, and make sure that everybody has a chance to be heard. So that's why we ended up going with sharing circles. So we had about 26 participants come, and we focused on different questions about mental health, you know, and people were sharing a lot about some of the different challenges of, you know, mental health, how pervasive it is. People also talked about the theme of walking in two worlds and, you know, the challenges of, you know, having to code switch in between cultures, you know, being in education and then being home with your community and some of the different expectations of that and the pressure that that can cause.
I'd just like to mention this was like Erica's thesis or research. And so I was just kind of helping in any way that I could. And one of the things that I think that we focused a lot on when it came to presenting was we focused a lot on what the students said. So we read direct quotes from them. And I think being able to give that voice in this way, I think is very meaningful and very impactful. I think that ultimately, you know, their words matter. And so we definitely wanted to make sure that we encapsulated that in our talk yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, that's so important.
Yeah.
So I have several, I'm at the Farmington Center of our university, and so we have a larger, specifically Navajo population there. So, and so many of my students talk about this and how tough it is and how, well, am I, you know, accepted here or not there? And so I really appreciate that you all are doing this because it's needed. And there are so many students who really, this will resonate with. Yeah.
I agree. I think that, you know, it is really important. And, you know, like Jen said, I think listening to people is one of the most important things that we can do and hear the stories that people are sharing about their mental health. So, yeah, we were really interested in this research as a way to kind of promote cultural competence, you know, and the way that we approach therapy whenever we're working with Native clients. And I think that just listening to people and asking, you know, what do you need, you know, and how can we be there for you? That's one of the most important things that we can do. And that's one of the things that we were hoping to do with this research.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can maybe highlight some of your findings on that, like, code switching, because I've got every semester I teach research methods, I have at least one or two students who, like, they want that to be their project.
Yes.
They want to talk about, like, that living in two worlds or kind of existing in two spaces. So whether it's a student from a more like a kind of traditionally Hispanic household, or if we're talking about like an Indigenous student who has to navigate those spaces, the kind of cultural space and then the academic space, and then this kind of project allows them to kind of see what research is there, and then they can't find a ton,
right.
Especially if they're looking at it from that Indigenous perspective. And so if you can like highlight a little bit of what you found regarding like what students were talking about and how the kind of they struggle or how they maybe overcome some of those struggles with code switching and doing that.
Yeah, I think that it is a lot of pressure, you know, and it is difficult. I think especially whenever you think about the Western education system and, you know, just Western culture in particular, it's very linear, you know, so one thing after another, you know, that's the way that we understand things. But with a lot of Native tribes, you know, their cultures are more cyclical and you focus on connections. And so that's a different way of writing. That's a different way of, you know, understanding the world. Oral traditions is, you know, something that we really focus on. And, you know, in Western academia, like we really focus on the written word.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some of that are, you know, some challenges. So having to learn new ways of learning, you know, and adapt to that while also staying true to, you know, the teachings of their ancestors and respecting their culture. So I think that it adds a lot of pressure. I think one of the things that can really help is finding community, you know, mm-hmm. in an academic space, you know, having people that you can talk to and who will understand you, and having like kind of a space where you don't have to constantly, you know, code switch, right. you know, and have support too, so that you can see that, you know, who you are and your traditions are good and useful, you know, in this realm as well.
Yeah. I wanted to just sort of add in there that, like, at Utah State, we do have, like, that's something that we focus on a lot, right? Like, we have, like, a program called MESAs, and that is basically mentoring and supporting Native students that go to Utah State schools. So we work with students at Blanding, in Blanding, Utah, and then as well as students in Logan. And so that part of like community is what we focus on a lot. We make sure that we are able to support Native students, especially those who are like very far from home. I mean, for me, from where I live to Logan is 9 hours. And so, and there are a lot of other Native students, like Navajo students, who go to Logan. And Logan is so different from anything on the res. Mm-hmm. And so we really like to focus a lot on community and being supportive. And we host talking circles. And that gives students an opportunity to be able to like navigate, continue to navigate what those two worlds are and like how to balance them. And so I think that's something that we really care about. And that's something we've been working on for a couple years now.
I guess it's the last question. Like normally we'd ask something with methodology, but I think maybe a better question that's in my head is, we have programs like you said, you have MESA. We have some similar like student organizations, and we have some faculty who are very involved in like working with our traditionally underrepresented students. But is there something that you can maybe see as like, you know, like if that's a good first step, like what's maybe the next step, or what's maybe something that we could pass along to faculty that are listening, that are students that listen, on what I could do in the classroom better, or what they could do in the classroom better to be just a little more aware? Because I mean, we could do like faculty development training, and that like only goes so far. Or, you know, hey, here's a PowerPoint, a little quiz to take to be like culturally sensitive. Right. But is there something that maybe we can be more, I guess, conscious or aware of when it comes to working with our Indigenous students or our underserved student populations that you've kind of learned from this project that you'd like to pass on?
Well, I think, and you know, I think Jen can talk about this as well, but we do have a cultural competence course for faculty about working with Indigenous students. So, yeah, that is something that we offer at Utah State. Our advisor, Melissa Teehee, she developed it, and so that's been really helpful. And I think one of the biggest takeaways from that course is really focusing on those connections and listening, you know, and being there to support Native students. I think because whenever a lot of Indigenous peoples are talking or learning or, you know, really trying to give respect to somebody, there's not a lot of eye contact being made.
Right.
And I think that in the classroom, you know, professors will see that and think, you know, oh, you know, this student's disengaged, you know, they aren't trying to learn. But the fact of the matter is it's actually the opposite. You know, it means that they're paying far more attention because they're not making eye contact. And so I think maybe being familiar with that, you know, and if something's going on and maybe there's a student that's not doing as well as you would hope, you know, even reaching out and seeing what you could do to support that student mm-hmm. could make a tremendous impact.
Yes. Yeah, just to add on to that, I think that when you were sort of asking about what you could do and what students can do, I think that immediately I thought of the cultural competence training. I think that that gives you an idea of it's basically a scenario in which there is a student who needs to go home because family needs them, and that student doesn't know how to talk to the professor about, I need to leave. And it's from these different perspectives, and I think that, like, that really gives people sort of a different perspective in seeing a situation.
Yes.
And seeing, like, you know, a Native student is trying to, you know, be a good student, but also has no idea how to communicate with someone who, a faculty member or a professor, like, right. It's intimidating. And so I really think that is very helpful. I don't know how likely it would be to be able to have that be more, like, widely disseminated to other universities and stuff like that, but that's something that we do at Utah State. And then as for students, I think that, like, again, trying to find that support, it's very difficult. You know, I think we've experienced that ourselves, like going to a college and being away from home, trying to find out, like, where your people are and stuff. And sometimes that requires a lot more effort on your part to, like, look up things, find a group. And all I can say is that once you find it, it's a group of people that I think you're going to hold on to for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. And thank you. Thank you again. I just can't say thank you enough.
Yeah, thank you
it was a pleasure.
Thank you both.
All right. Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. We're back at RMPA, and we have another research presentation to discuss. So I will let y'all introduce yourselves, tell us where you're from, and kind of give us an overview of what you've been researching.
Okay. My name's Devin Rapkin. I'm an undergraduate student of psychology at MSU Denver, and I've been working on this research project with my faculty advisor for two semesters now? Okay, yeah.
My name is Lisa Hagen. I work at Metropolitan State University of Denver, and I'm a faculty member specializing in developmental psychology. And Devin and I have been working on this for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent. Would you like to walk us through what your research is?
Sure. So we first got interested in this topic about a year and a half ago, where we had some students who were involved in working in the different campus resources, and they were saying how nobody was using the campus resources that are available. And we found that to be very disheartening, because we know there's students out there who have needs, and we hope that as a university we're able to attend to those needs. Mm-hmm. But they just weren't using them. And so we launched this study to look at how many needs, basic needs, do our students have. Are they food insecure? Are they housing insecure? Do they have mental health challenges? And then how much they are actually using different campus resources, such as the counseling center or emergency funds or the food pantry. And if they're not using them, why not? And so maybe, Devin, you can talk to how that leads us to this study.
Yeah, so we noticed the discrepancy between student needs and the actual utilization of all the resources that are on campus. And so we wanted to identify those reasons, and so we looked at a bunch of different things, the different barriers, structural barriers, cultural barriers, inter and intrapersonal barriers. This past semester we've been really looking at stigma, because that seems to be universal for almost all students. It doesn't matter your race, gender, or whatever. We all experience stigma with reaching out for help on some level.
Past research in this area has really focused on unmet student needs at community colleges or some four-year private schools, but we have not found any research looking at an urban university and a commuter campus. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that our population of students have a much higher need than other types of students. Specifically, we found that 64% of our student body reports food insecurity, 52% report housing insecurity, 83% have anxiety, ranging from mild to severe, and 65% rated as having clinical depression. Mm-hmm. So there's a big need on our campus.
It sounds like, you know, like every time I read one of those like Chronicle of Higher Ed articles, and it's like students are dealing with this and students are dealing with that. And like you talk to the people at your school and they're like, yeah, no one's coming to get our resources and we have these things. And I'm sure if you talk to the people at our university, they'd say the same thing. And no one's like, yeah, maybe we should actually study this or look at it.
Well, you're right. When we look to see what percentage of students actually use the resources, the most was the food pantry, but only 14%.
Oh, wow.
And as I said, over 60% have a level of food insecurity, so it's disheartening to see that only 14% are actually using our pretty good food pantry on campus. Mm-hmm. And then less than 9% seek counseling, free counseling. And then it's under 5% for all of the other campus resources, including psychiatric services, the Learning Accommodation Center, emergency funds, LGBTQ resources, and immigration services. So, yeah, that's where we started to look at why. And maybe Devin can talk about stigma.
So we developed a Qualtrics survey that we had, 301 mm-hmm. participants total take, and it had a bunch of different measures relating to either depression, anxiety, and a lot of it was, you know, do you experience this need? And then we would ask about the actual campus resource, and not just whether they use it or not, but whether they're even are aware of it, as well as if they don't use it and they are experiencing a need, why do they not use it, to kind of like hone in on those actual specific help-seeking barriers they're experiencing. And yes, stigma is like what kept coming up again and again, and that really matches the literature. And so I think, like, large picture, what the study is telling us is that nobody seems to really understand or know how to really address stigma, specifically in student populations. Like, we've known for a while now that stigma really acts as a barrier for students in all sorts of domains. Yet, it's not really changing, even though the resources are becoming more accessible, largely, as well as just more prevalent. The stigma is still, like, just, like, has a death grip on students, and we really need to like understand why and how to mitigate that to kind of see that actual change that we're seeking.
So what are the next steps from this research? Have y'all started brainstorming like how to start reducing stigma within your campus community?
Yes, I have been like thinking about this just because this is, you know, this semester's findings, and I think there's a lot of great ways that we could try it. Whether they'll actually work, that'll be the next, you know,
the next study.
The next study. But I think that marketing is a huge point, and obviously marketing happens, but I don't think the marketing's very well, and also just the sheer volume of marketing, because I think the amount of marketing that people see can slowly chip away at the idea that, like, oh, I don't want to like talk about the fact that I don't know where my next meal is coming from. Mm-hmm. Like if you just see all around you that like there's all these food resources because lots of students are experiencing food insecurity, you might not feel as weird about it. And then me personally, this is just my soapbox, but I think representation is huge. And so we service a lot of ethnic minorities at our school, a lot of Latinx students. And we do have a decent LGBTQ population as well. And I personally think that just making those students feel like they actually belong on campus will influence their perceived stigma around accessing the resources. As an LGBTQ student myself, I know that sometimes just feeling like I belong somewhere will, you know, incentivize me to reach out to the people that could help me with something. Because if I don't feel like I belong somewhere, I'm not going to reach out to you for help. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You don't feel like you're going to get the help from. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Like if you're chipping away at stigma in the other areas, it's kind of bleeding into that.
And yeah.
I definitely see the marketing issue.
Mm-hmm.
We get the, here's your campus, you know, the campus pantry is open and it's like at the beginning of the semester and then like maybe at midterms and then maybe at the end, but it's lost in that mm-hmm. flood of emails mm-hmm. that we get on a daily basis.
Well, and you bring up a good point that it's like professors will talk about it, put it in their syllabus, send out emails and such, but, you know, where are people my age really paying attention?
Right.
And it's like, social media.
Mm-hmm.
That is where everyone's attention is. And so I think getting student-led employees to really kind of like amp up the marketing on social media mm-hmm. for the school, not just for resources, for anything, could really help change the narrative of students feeling involved and mm-hmm. like they belong. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just want to echo what Devin said. I think it's kind of a double-edged sword where we definitely don't market this stuff well at all. I mean, when I asked about where are students getting information about these resources, I hear, well, they hear it at orientation. Well, you hear a lot of things at orientation mm-hmm. when you're a brand new student, but how much do you actually remember?
Mm-hmm.
But then when I have mentioned to administration, well, we really need to amp up our marketing, it's like, well, the problem is if more people find out about them and use them, we don't have enough money.
Oh.
So
funding, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, right now the food pantry, 14% of students use it, but if 64% have a need and that 14% went to 64%, my guess is there's just not enough money to go around. So
it sounds like something, though, that would be really good to spend money on.
Doesn't it?
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, who do I convince?
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
I also wonder, too, so when I worked at my previous school, they had every semester an HIV syphilis testing day. Mm-hmm. And so I, particularly for my human sexuality class, during class time, I was like, all right, guys, we're going to the health clinic. You don't have to get tested if you don't want to. But you do need to see like the process on how to do this. And so we would all leave the classroom together and, you know, make a chain, walk to the clinic. And then about 80% of the students would still get tested just so they could have that experience. And then they would continuously get tested the rest of the time that they were in the program.
I did something similar. My first day of class, I have them do a selfie activity that Dr. Sanders actually created where in small groups, they take a selfie of the group and then text it to me so that I can begin to learn their names. But I expanded that by saying, go to the food pantry, take a selfie of yourselves.
Yeah.
The food pantry, go to the counseling center, take a selfie in front of them, so that they can just see these resources mm-hmm. on campus and know where they are.
Absolutely.
And then I give a little spiel about how, you know, it's free. Why wouldn't you? Never in life are you ever going to get free therapy again.
Mm-hmm.
Take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something like an extra step beyond just here's the sources in like the syllabus to like orienting them to the semester by actually physically going to the place.
You may be able to like even get some of that funding with that too, because like maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy for the administration where like
yes.
the students aren't using it because they're not being told, so it doesn't cost them as much money. And so that keeps students using it. But if more students started using it and they're running out, they have to kind of inject, or they have to get rid of it, which is even, I think, worse press for them at that point.
Well, my thought behind that is even if you just did it kind of as a experiment, let's say you do pour more money into these resources and marketing so that you can help more students. If their academic success increases, then you're churning out better students, which in turn usually, not always, but usually increases enrollment rates. Mm-hmm. So if you have more students, I mean, that's another stream of income. And just like you said, it's this self-fulfilling prophecy.
So it's a win-win for everyone involved. And yeah, just the things that we should be spending money on versus the things that, like, you know, maybe don't benefit us as much. So... no, it's really fascinating, and it's really eye-opening, because like that is definitely something that, like, I mean, I see it at our university. It is not, you know, it's not a one, this is a pretty, I would argue, it's probably a universal thing. It doesn't matter where you are. So, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Do you have any, I guess, last thoughts, anything else to add?
I don't think so.
All right. No, great. Awesome.
Cool. Right on.
What you're doing.
Yeah, no. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.